step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. For the last third of the 19th century, Union General Stephen Gano Burbridge, also known as the Butcher of Kentucky, enjoyed the distinction of being the most hated man in that state. This is because from mid-1864, just months into his beginning as the military commander of the state, until his death in December 1894, the mention of his name triggered a firestorm of curses from writers and politicians in the South. By the end of his tenure, Governor Thomas Bramlett concluded that he was an imbecile commander whose actions represented nothing but the blundering of a weak intellect and an overwhelming vanity. Well, here's why he was so hated. He was known for his heavy-handedness to suppress attacks on Union citizens. Kentucky was under Union control, but there was significant Confederate guerrilla activity in that state. On July 16, 1864, Burbridge issued Order No. 59, which declared, "Whenever an unarmed Union citizen is murdered, four guerrillas will be selected from prison and publicly shot to death at the most convenient place near the scene of the outrages." During this time, he also directed the imprisonment of numerous people, including public figures, for treason and other high crimes. And he also arrested prominent people who favored the Democratic candidate George McClellan, who ran against Abraham Lincoln in 1864. But despite his unpopular opinion, he was an effective commander. He led Union assaults against the Salt Works near the town of Saltville, Virginia, as part of the First Battle of Saltville. Among his forces were Black Cavalry, later organized as the 5th United States Colored Cavalry Regiment. So in this way, he oversaw and sped along the destruction of slavery by administering the recruitment and enlistment of enslaved people as soldiers. Today's guest is Brad Asher, author of a new biography on Burbridge. We discuss how he earned his infamous reputation, and Asher argues that he was basically the scapegoat for white Kentuckians, including many in the Unionist political elite, who were unshakably opposed to emancipation. And after the war, as Kentucky identified more closely to the South and identified with its Confederate past, some people's reputation were unfairly tarnished, and Asher argues that Burbridge is among these people. So this is a very interesting, nuanced, revisionist account of a very important Civil War figure, and it also shows the complexity of trying to maintain order in a part of the United States that was under significant guerrilla assault. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Brad Asher. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate the invitation.
Right. We're going to talk about somebody, Stephen Burbridge. He was a Civil War general. And when I did a series a couple years ago, Key Battles of the Civil War, with co-host James Early, there were all these fascinating people that we mentioned, but because we had so much ground to cover, we could really only mention them in passing. So it's a great opportunity to come and circle back and dwell on one of these really interesting figures. This person in particular, Burbridge, had many nicknames. One of them was the Butcher of Kentucky. I don't know where it came from. Very well could have been from the many journalists and politicians who hated him. When you were doing archival research about him and you noted how much he was despised, Were there any descriptions of him or accounts in the press that really stuck out to you as you were doing your research?
Yes, there were quite a few. In fact, the Butcher of Kentucky is kind of tame compared to some of them, like blood-stained tyrant, a demon in human shape, plunderer and murderer of our innocent citizens. One journalist from Frankfurt, actually, he wrote that he regretted that this person he knew was a Christian gentleman because he had refused to shoot Burbridge when he encountered him in Washington, D.C. And then my favorite, though, probably from the a newspaper called the Maysville Bulletin. Maysville's a little town in Kentucky, which called Burbridge a paupered, lecherous, despised, and criminal outcast whose soul would be eternally denied rest in the hereafter. So there's a lot of good ones out there if you like looking up 19th century newspaper insults.
All right. And I have to say that rhetoric at the time was really capable of amazing things. I think we've lost something where open insults was part of the discourse of the time, and they didn't hold back then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even
did not hold back.
I mean, one of the tamer ones, like you said, Butcher of Kentucky was tame. Governor Thomas Bramlett, he said that he was an imbecile commander whose actions represented nothing but the blundering of weak intellect and an overwhelming vanity while he was governor at the time during Burbridge's rule. So let's get some context of his background. I think that could help explain his story. Tell me about his early military career up to the Civil War.
Okay, so he did not really have a military career up until the Civil War. He did attend the Kentucky Military Institute, which was one of these private military academies as a boy. But, you know, he didn't distinguish himself. He was not of the student corps or anything like that. When the Civil War broke out, he joined the Army and organized and recruited an infantry regiment and was commissioned a colonel. And that was really the beginning of his military career. Now, his family history, he had, like a lot of prominent Kentuckians from the Bluegrass region of Kentucky, he had a military lineage. His grandfather fought in the Revolution. His father and uncle fought in the War of 1812. So he had a kind of military heritage. But that was not uncommon, as I say, among kind of sons of the Bluegrass. It was kind of stereotypically Kentuckian for you to trace your lineage back through people who fought in the War of 1812 or who fought in the Revolution. So it was really the Civil War that began his military career.
And could you very briefly sketch out Kentucky's place in the Civil War? I know this isn't easy to do to summarize, but I think those who haven't studied much, they imagine that the line between the Confederacy and the Union is thick and firm, and you're either very solidly Union or very solidly Confederate. I live in Missouri, and that was definitely not the case. So there was as much violence and bloodshed due to guerrilla warfare, if not for the actual major battles that took place, if not much more. So can you describe just the state of Kentucky during the Civil War so we understand what Burbridge was dealing with as a general?
Sure. Kentucky has a really complicated and interesting Civil War history in terms of guerrilla warfare. It's a little like Missouri light. I mean, it has an ongoing guerrilla conflict through most of the war, especially late in the war, and that is Burbridge's primary military challenge. There's not a lot of major battles fought in Kentucky, but there is this interesting thing, which I think Kentucky is the only state that tried to do this. When it broke out, it declared officially that it was going to be neutral, would not join the Confederacy, would not join the Union. Both armies began to maneuver and violated the borders of the state. And eventually the state legislature ordered the Confederate Army to leave, didn't order the Union Army to leave. And thus Kentucky was officially aligned with the Union, which is a fact that a lot of modern day Kentuckians don't actually know or are uncertain about which side Kentucky was on. But it was officially a Union state, even though it had like Missouri, it had a high proportion of Confederate sympathizing among its population. A goodly number of Kentuckians decamped the state and went and volunteered and fought in the Confederate Army. And of course, you had throughout the war, but again, especially later on, just a regular bunch of insurgents and irregular attacks on Union citizens and Union infrastructure by organized guerrilla bands and also kind of less organized bands of just men who supported the Confederate cause, but were not regularly involved in the conflict.
I don't know if it's possible to compare it to modern war, but with the occupation of Kentucky, with some citizens who do sympathize, many who do not, and as you said, support the Confederate cause, could it be compared to something like Vietnam or the Iraq War to give by means of analogy and understanding of what it was like to control an area with intense guerrilla activity?
It is difficult, but I would say it's more comparable to like the Iraq War, because the Confederacy tried twice to invade Kentucky and they were repulsed both times. So after the Battle of Perryville, which is October 1862, the kind of regular military war is over in Kentucky. The Confederates never make another like big attempt to conquer the state. So that's a little like Operation Enduring Freedom in Iraq, where the regular military phase is over very quickly. And then you have this kind of slow burn of guerrilla insurgency, the occasional cavalry raid into the state. But it is the difficulty of trying to control a population, and again, especially late in the war, growing increasingly unsympathetic to the way you are fighting the war.
Jumping to June 1864, when Burbridge is given command of the District of Kentucky to deal with this growing problem of guerrilla campaigns, tell me about what happens. What does he do differently? And describe this next stage, which is really the action of your book.
Right. As I said in the book, it's a strange biography, because the bulk of the book is taken up with a year of its subject's life, which is really March 64, which is when he gets his official appointment, to February 1865. But you're right to single out June, because June is an important month. He's been officially in power for about 3 months by June. He's heard constant kind of intelligence, bad and good, about invasions coming through the mountains of southwestern Virginia, about invasions coming up from Tennessee. You know, he kind of deploys his forces in small squads and detachments after there are guerrilla attacks to kind of do a kind of chase and arrest strategy, or a chase and disperse strategy. But what he's really concerned about most is that Confederate General John Hunt Morgan, who's also a Kentuckian, is going to make another raid into Kentucky from Virginia. Now, Morgan had made by that time 3 raids into Kentucky, and his last one in 1863 is the one where he actually crossed the Ohio River. He raided some towns in Ohio, and it ended with his arrest and his imprisonment in the Ohio State Penitentiary. He then escaped from the Ohio State Penitentiary with several of his officers, made his way back to Virginia. And so by spring and summer of 1864, he's looking to kind of redeem his reputation by getting back into Kentucky. And Burbridge hears intelligence about this. He musters his forces. And he thinks, I'm going to hit Morgan before he can get into Kentucky, hit him while he's organizing his forces, and that'll give me the advantage. And of course, Morgan, being very clever cavalry raider, gets into Kentucky first, and Burbridge ends up chasing him through the bluegrass region of the state. And eventually, on June 12th, 1864, Morgan has been delayed at the town of Cynthiana, Kentucky, been delayed both by the defense of the town by that kind of small group of Unionists who are in the town, but also by one of Burbridge's lieutenants who comes down from Cincinnati and holds him up for 5 or 6 hours while Burbridge is reinforcing and rearming in Lexington, and then is running low ammunition, and his lower ranking officers saying, you know, we should really get out of here. And Morgan decides that he will turn and fight Burbridge. And on June 12th, in a matter of a couple of hours, his command is destroyed. And his men try to swim across the Licking River and end up drowning. Morgan himself makes it and makes his way back to Virginia, but a lot of his troops do not. And several of them actually end up staying in Kentucky, and they kind of start to freelance. And so you see a lot of guerrilla activity peak or pick up after Morgan's defeat, because several of his men are in the state. They don't, they're not really under anybody's control or command. They just decide to carry on the war on their own on detached duty. And that is one of Burbridge's guerrilla problems.
Does he institute martial law immediately after he's given command of the District of Kentucky?
He does not. It's interesting because legally, Kentucky was under martial law even before Burbridge took office. But Lincoln periodically kind of renews the Declaration of Martial Law, and he renews it for the final time and for the first time that Burbridge has been in command in July, just after Morgan's defeat, saying that when these Confederate cavalry raiders have come into the state, they've been aided by citizens, and that the civil authorities are no longer able to control the situation. So he redeclares martial law, which, again, I've read legally he didn't need to, but it gives more, it gives directly empowers Burbridge to start taking harsher actions against the guerrillas.
Now, one thing as an aside before getting into the more controversial aspects of his tenure, I should state here that he was a young man when all this was happening. He's born in 1831. He's in his early 30s. And that's always an interesting part of the Civil War history, because you have some people who enter as privates, others who are officers simply because they are able to put together a regiment or a militia. And despite having little or sometimes no military experience, do shockingly well. And then other times you have military veterans who, despite going to West Point Academy, despite earning some medals due to limited or perhaps no action in the Mexican-American War, do very poorly. So, it's an interesting test case because you have people from very, very diverse backgrounds that you don't see in later wars in American history. So what was Burbridge like, I mean, as a commander? Did he execute his office well despite being a very young man, or was he visibly green in how he ran his office?
That's a really interesting point, because he was very young, and as a kind of a commander in the field. So as I said earlier, he recruited this regiment in Kentucky. He was pretty rapidly promoted to a brigadier general, largely because he had influential friends. So he was a kind of rose through the ranks very quickly. In fact, when his friends first started pushing him for promotion, the Union general in charge of the theater that he was in at the time said, "So many people are pushing these young, unproven officers up for brigade command. I just don't think they're ready." And Burbridge was one of those. But nonetheless, the pressure campaign works. He's named a brigadier general, and he actually does pretty well when he's in the field. He is involved in the Battle of Arkansas Post in Missouri, and his troops capture the fort, you know, take the surrender, and then he gets involved brigade is part of the army of the corps of the army that is part of the Vicksburg campaign. Again, his troops fight really well. They are he is well respected by his troops, and they have a number of important victories on the march to Vicksburg. And then he is, after Vicksburg, he's assigned to kind of almost like garrison duty in Louisiana. And he really, he's doing a lot of what he'll do in Kentucky. He chases guerrillas, he confiscates sugar and cotton. And he is finding that this is very frustrating, and he'd rather do it in Kentucky. So he resigns his command in Louisiana and is given then command in Kentucky, first off as a temporary fill-in because the previous commander had been dismissed, and the person they wanted to come take it was on court-martial duty and was not available. So Burbridge was named as a kind of temporary fill-in that then becomes permanent, again, because of the influence of the Unionist, his Unionist allies in the state. And it's then when he takes over as a kind of administrator of the military district that you start to see some, I wouldn't call it greenness, but a little, like a lot of Union commanders, he gets very overcautious about his use of troops. He leads in addition to the Morgan fight, in which he did perform very well, he leads two expeditions against these salt works in southwestern Virginia that are important to the Confederacy, kind of for food preservation and things, but are not exactly critical infrastructure. And the first time he fails and is returned to the state. And then the second time he's actually under the command of another general, and the other general kind of urges him to attack. And he says, oh, I'm waiting for my men to come up. I'll attack in a while. And just shows a lot of hesitation and caution that you didn't see when he was a commander in the field. So as a military man, I would say he maybe on average gets a B minus. But then as an administrator and as an anti-guerrilla a commander, he never led troops in the field against guerrilla bands, even though those bands could be quite sizable. And he was kind of hamstrung by the fact that Kentucky, the number of federal troops in Kentucky was kind of continually on the decline from June through the rest of the war. So he never really had enough troops to kind of secure all portions of the state. So like I say, he ended up kind of, he would hear of a guerrilla attack or a rumor of a guerrilla attack. He would kind of concentrate his forces in a place and he would send them out. And usually, very often, you know, they might catch one or two of them, but the bulk of them had dispersed then into the bush and among the general population. So that's what led him to try, I think, some of his more controversial tactics to counter the guerrillas.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text UNPLUGGED to 30605.
The best known of these, as far as I know, is Order Number 59. Tell me about what this is and what are notable cases of how it was used.
So Order 59, he issued in July 16, 1864, and it specified that any time an unarmed Unionist citizen was killed during a guerrilla raid, four prisoners that were in the hands of the military authorities would be taken to the site of the attack and publicly executed. Over 60 men were executed under the auspices of Order 59. It also called for the banishment of citizens in the area, Confederate sympathizing citizens in the area who may have aided the guerrillas. But There's very little in the records that those banishments actually happened. What you most read about are the executions. And they were, I mean, they were quite brutal. I mean, there were numerous instances where they would bring citizens out to watch the execution and just to make sure, you know, that they were receiving the message not to aid and abet these guerrillas. And I think the kind of logic behind the order was that by retaliating against the people he held in prison, it would be a deterrent to the guerrillas still in the field. But I think that logic is the logic behind Order 59 is kind of flawed because the guerrillas in the field didn't have a lot of loyalty to the folks that were in jail. They were not their compatriots. There was not this kind of one unified guerrilla organization that looked upon those people in the jails as their comrades. Most of the independent operators, and they would occasionally, some of the command would raise concerns with Burbridge about the treatment of their men, but not about the treatment of other men. So as a deterrent, it didn't really work to keep the guerrillas at bay. So I say in the book that if you just judge it on its effectiveness, Order 59 was a failure.
That's an interesting point. And that's a question that in history we've come back to many times of how do you successfully put down a guerrilla uprising? Do you use punitive measures and punish the local population for supporting them? But what happens often is that you go so heavy-handed that it has the opposite impact. In World War I, you saw that all the time. The local population will despise you and it will cause an public sentiment to push against you. Sherman's March to the Sea tried to have it both ways, where fields might be burned, but locals themselves wouldn't be attacked and non-combatants wouldn't be attacked. But you noted that it wasn't very effective. How does this play out as the year goes on? Does local opinion start to turn against him, or does it mostly stay on a level amount during this year?
It starts to turn against him, and it's very interesting kind of the way it turns against him, because if you look at the politics of Kentucky, the unionists, the majority of unionists in Kentucky were pro-slavery unionists because Kentucky was a slave state. So they wanted to stay in the union because the union had preserved slavery since the founding of the Constitution. And they believed that if they seceded, they would lose all the federal protections of slavery, like, you know, the laws, the fugitive slave law and the constitutional clauses that protected slavery. So they rejected secession, but at the same time, they also rejected abolition and emancipation. So that was the basis upon which they stayed in the union. And so with the Emancipation Proclamation, and then especially once Burbridge takes command, he is given authority to enroll and enlist Kentucky slaves as troops. And when the enslaved population begins to enlist, of course, they get their freedom. And so slaves kind of start flocking to the recruiting centers. And all of a sudden, these pro-slavery unionists are like, this is not what we signed up for. And this is becoming a war that we don't agree with. And that we strongly think strongly is being waged the wrong way. And so they begin to protest in all sorts of ways, sending petitions to Washington and letters to Lincoln. And these are not like rank and file unionists. These are heavy hitters in Kentucky politics, the kind of powers that be. And so they have kind of been disenchanted with the war even before Burbridge begins to crack down on things to kind of control that dissent. So, and it's not the guerrilla executions so much that bothers the pro-slavery unionists, because they have, I mean, there are people dying on fields of battle in the hundreds and thousands. So the execution of a few dozen military prisoners doesn't bother them so much. What really bothers the pro-slavery unionists during the war is that Burbridge starts to arrest them and crack down on newspapers and actions of dissent and really crack down on civil liberties because he accuses them of disloyal and treasonable practices by their speeches and their kind of rallies. It's the butcher of Kentucky name really gets associated with Burbridge after the war. Once there's a kind of vocal pro-Confederate population in the state, the people that came back from the Confederacy after fighting for them, or people that finally felt free to express their pro-Confederate sympathies, they really harp on the guerrilla killings as illegitimate, as military murders. And it's really after the war that he kind of earns this title of the butcher of Kentucky. And that kind of piles on to this already existing disillusionment with the Union cause that had existed because of the emancipation policies.
I want to come back to the Saltville Massacre because this plays a lot into his legacy. And a point that you make in your book is that he sped along abolition and the destruction of slavery. I was surprised in the 1864 presidential campaign how hard he works to suppress support for George McClellan, the Democratic candidate, and support the reelection of Lincoln, which, I mean, I understand in the Civil War that civil liberties are eroded. Lincoln, in different cases, suspends habeas corpus. What does Burbridge do here, and why does he do it?
What I argue in the book is that by that time in 1864, the definition of loyalty to the Union has kind of shifted from merely wanting the rebellion and restore the Union to also including the destruction of slavery. So if you're on board with the Union, you're on board with both those aspects of it. And what Burbridge saw in this dissent was really disloyalty. And that is why I think he begins to really work against the campaign for McClellan, because McClellan had promised there would be no preconditions regarding slavery in terms of prosecuting the war. And he campaigned for Lincoln because he had kind of invested himself in the Lincolnian strategy, this kind of two-pronged strategy of crushing the rebellion and crushing slavery. And so he was interested in seeing Lincoln's victory, not so much because he's a kind of committed to emancipation, but he is committed to, he's invested his future in the way the Lincoln administration is prosecuting the war. And to kind of backtrack on that would have left him exposed to, I think, criticism and, even possibly removal by his higher-ups in the Union Army who had to kind of all thrown in with Lincoln. So it's not like Burbridge was inventing all this. He would issue a policy, and Sherman, who was his direct commander, or Stanton, who was Secretary of War, they would say, you go do it, root out all the disloyalty in Kentucky. We support you 100%. So his bread was kind of buttered on the Lincoln side of the Lincoln side of whatever the finish of that analogy is. But he is an unconditional unionist who is willing to follow the Lincoln administration's emancipation policy wherever it might lead.
Right. And when you read about some actions, like he arrests prominent persons who favor McClellan, and this includes Lieutenant Governor Richard Jacob and Judge Bullitt, and both of those are deported. Now, when you first just hear that out of context, you think this sounds like Mussolini's fascist Italy, where the machinery of corporations and the state and the military are all being used together to trample on individual liberties. But a point you make is that the things he does, such as that or the execution of guerrillas, was somewhat standard protocol in the Civil War. Is that a correct assessment, or how do you place his actions in the context of what's happening at the time?
Certainly the retaliatory executions, and you would know this from what you know of Missouri, it is part of the toolkit for Union commanders who are facing an insurgency, that if they can apprehend guerrillas, they often resort to summary execution. They often resort to inflicting punishment upon the surrounding civilian population as a way to quell sympathy for the guerrillas. So none of his actions are totally out of line with what other Union commanders had done in other regions facing a similar situation. The one possible caveat to that is that Kentucky was a Union state. It was not kind of occupied territory of the Confederacy, and it did have a semi-functioning civil government. So there were arguments about whether whether the military was the best institution to carry out those retributive policies. But the argument of the military, of course, was that the civil administration was in bed or hopelessly corrupted by pro-Southern sympathies. And so you couldn't put these people on civil trial. You couldn't let the courts have them because they would simply free them. So there is a great deal of mutual suspicion growing up between the kind of civil side of Kentucky life and the military side of Kentucky life.
Another thing that we mentioned earlier that I want to come back to is the Saltville Massacre, which ties into the incorporation of a number of Black soldiers, and then some of his forces are Black cavalry, that are organized as the 5th United States Colored Cavalry Regiment. And can you tell me about the significance of this event and then also what impact it has on his legacy in Kentucky?
Sure. The Saltville Massacre occurred after Burbridge's first assault on the Salt Works. When he withdrew from that engagement, he left his wounded on the field under the care of his regimental surgeons, which was not unusual. And they were expected to receive, as wounded, they might be taken prisoner, or but certainly nothing was supposed to happen to them after the battle. And the morning after he withdrew, so several hours after the battle ended, there were numerous reports of Confederate soldiers on the field of battle executing wounded Black soldiers that had been left behind. And the numbers are disputed. Some historians say it was, 100 or so. Some say it was like a dozen. The most careful research that I've seen put the number at between 50 and 60. And it's an atrocity along the lines of the Fort Pillow Massacre, which is way more famous, particularly because it happened kind of after the battle was over, when they had ample opportunity to. It was not a hot-headed crime of passion. In other words, it was a deliberate move to execute them. And there's a lot of controversy around it about whether Confederate officers knew, or whether it was actually uniformed Confederate soldiers who did it, or some of the kind of guerrilla hangers-on that were part of it. Champ Ferguson, who is a Kentucky guerrilla, kind of notorious Kentucky guerrilla, was part of that. And he actually later went into a field hospital and executed a few more wounded Black troops. But at the time, it was regarded as, I guess, not all that significant. Its significance has grown as time has passed. But I think what it shows is the absolute anger and fury with which the Confederacy viewed the recruitment and use of Black soldiers. They would not countenance it in any way, in that they were not entitled to the normal respect that a wounded soldier would get on the field of battle. And that's just a reflection of the hostility of the Confederate soldiery to the use of Black troops. And that's where its significance lies. There is an exchange of letters between Burbridge and Confederate general, name escapes me at the moment, and the Confederate general accuses Burbridge of holding him responsible for the Saltville Massacre, and Burbridge just says, no, I know who's responsible for it, and if Champ Ferguson ever falls into Union hands, he can expect no mercy. So there is a kind of current controversy, there is a contemporary controversy about it at the time, but it's mainly about who's responsible. The kind of historiography on it has been it was kind of ignored for a long time, and then and lately it has been elevated as part of this kind of reckoning with a large number of these kind of massacres and atrocities that occurred regarding Black soldiers all over the South and including in Kentucky.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.
Once in a generation, a podcast comes along with the power and eloquence to inspire us all.
This show will entertain you while you wait for that one. Join two best friends, author and former history teacher John Driver and comedian Johnny W. for hilarious and authentic conversations about life, history, culture, faith, and everything in between.
You can listen to Talk About That wherever you find your podcasts or at lifeaudio.com.
Well, he never gets along well with civil authorities there because, as you mentioned, there's mutual distrust on both sides. He wonders if he sends guerrillas to local prisons, then juries will simply let them go, and he can't manage peace or maintain security if he leaves too much to civil authorities. So there's this friction, which ultimately leads to his dismissal. So can you tell me about his dismissal and what happens to him after the war is over?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There's this, it's interesting, the governor at the time, whose name we may not have mentioned, Thomas Bramlett, he's a Union officer who then runs for office. And he initially is on Burbridge's side. I mean, he is one of the ones who pushes Ulysses Grant to name Burbridge permanently to the position of command of Kentucky. And then over the course of Burbridge's tenure as commander, they just continually butt heads until by the end, Bramlett is calling for his removal. And as you mentioned at the top, calling him an imbecile with a weak intellect and a boundless vanity. So they definitely have a falling out, and it is eventually after the election in November 1864, when Lincoln loses Kentucky, Burbridge makes another series of arrests of kind of prominent Democrats and kind of these conservative Unionist politicians, and Bramlett protests strongly to Lincoln that if this is an election ploy, it's needless, and he continues to oppress our citizens. And at that time, by the time Lincoln is reelected, he is kind of, I guess, he has to choose between whether he's going to back Burbridge up on this attempt to kind of police disloyalty in Kentucky, or whether he wants to kind of pacify the powers that be in Burbridge. And since his reelection has been assured, he and Grant start batting around names for replacements soon in November. And then in February 1865, Burbridge is formally removed and relieved from duty as commander. And then after his replacement is actually somebody who continues a lot of Burbridge's policies actually regarding slavery and emancipation, who is General John Palmer. Though he is not a Kentuckian, he is from Illinois, and he had a strong reputation as an abolitionist before he came to Kentucky as commander. But he follows up on Burbridge's policies regarding slavery, and by the end of the war, slavery is mostly done away with. 71% of Kentucky's slaves are free by April of 1865. So So it's not like there's a repudiation of Burbridge's policies by the guy that comes after him, although he does have a different guerrilla fighting strategy. But there is an attempt to kind of pacify Kentucky politicians by removing Burbridge. And then after the war, there are a number of opportunities that are presented to Burbridge. He has a brother who kind of sends him this series of letters like, hey, let's open a sawmill in Tennessee. Hey, let's open a cotton plantation in Louisiana. Hey, let's open a cattle ranch in Texas. Burbridge never really takes him up on any of these, although he does for a time try to run a sawmill in Tennessee, and he ends up bankrupt by 1867, declares bankruptcy, and is in pretty dire straits. And then through the late 1860s and early 1870s, he works as a claims attorney in a town just across the river in Kentucky, just across the river from Cincinnati. He works as a claims attorney for a while, although, again, he's often accused of all these villainies and vile things he did during the war, which tend to sabotage his career and his clientele. He is active for a little while after the war in Republican politics in Kentucky. But he's, because of the way that his reputation is being blackened by these kind of lost cause advocates in the state, he becomes a liability to the party pretty early. And they begin to kind of turn their backs on him by the early 1870s. And then finally, in about 1872 or 73, he leaves the state and moves to Washington, D.C. He campaigns very heavily for a patronage position, some kind of appointment from the federal government as some kind of reward for his wartime service, and he's never successful. The list of appointments he applied for is as long as your arm, and he doesn't ever really get any kind of reward for his service. And that's largely because every time he comes close, a Kentucky politician will step up and say, no, we won't allow this guy to have a position with the federal government. We won't vote to confirm it. He has a number of kind of duels in the press with people over his record and over the history of what happened in the war in Kentucky. And eventually he marries a fairly wealthy widow from Philadelphia. By the late 1870s, he spends a couple of years on a kind of honeymoon tour of Europe. He lives a couple of years in Saratoga in New York, and eventually he and his new wife settle in Brooklyn, and he dies there in 1894. He's buried in Arlington.
Well, it's interesting that the reputation that is highlighted by the title of your book lives on for a very long time. I was looking at articles related to him. One appeared in the Kentucky Explorer in 1995 that's entitled, Union General Burbridge Brought Hate and Terror to His Kentucky, which I'm sure you can find factual accounts that back that up, but this fits a larger narrative that you're describing here. So the question is, why does this reputation follow him for decades and over a century afterwards? And what do you think his fair due is in light of what he encountered in Kentucky?
Let me take the first part first. The reputation, I think, follows him because there is a pretty serious cultural project in Kentucky that lasts from the end of the war till the turn of the century or later, to create a kind of pro-Southern public memory of the Civil War in Kentucky. So there's a lot of the stuff you see across in other parts of the South: monument building, veneration of the Confederate dead, celebration of those who fought for Kentucky, or who fought for the Confederacy, who came from Kentucky. And as a piece of that larger project, there is this kind of reputational blackening of Burbridge, so that he becomes the butcher. He has all this negative press coverage that goes on. The people interested in kind of promoting this lost cause view of the war in Kentucky kind of continually bring up his memory in public events. There are monuments built to some of the victims of the executions. There are public reinterments of some of the victims of the execution. And these are always accompanied by speeches declaring how much Kentucky suffered at the hands of its federal oppressor, just like the South did. And so there's this attempt to link Kentucky's experience during the war with the South's experience. And it's very, very effective. I mean, by the 1890s, Kentucky is basically a pro-Confederate Southern-leaning state. And the efforts at emancipation and the Unionist aspects of the war have largely been forgotten or suppressed through this cultural project. And then, you know, by the time Burbridge dies in 1894, that in the press coverage of his death, there is a kind of repeat and repetition of his crimes and his harsh measures. But even the Courier Journal, the Louisville newspaper, comments that as the war grows further and further in the background, that the intense hatred of Burbridge has kind of declined. People don't, he's not on the tips of other people's of people's tongues like he used to be. But because of this kind of dominant cultural narrative that exists in Kentucky at this time, when historians write about the Civil War in Kentucky, they tend to take that view of him as a green, inexperienced, aspiring dictator who kind of went off the deep end in pursuing guerrillas and Confederate sympathizers and engaged in these kind of serial murders. And a lot of nuance gets lost in that portrait, and a lot of the context, the wartime context of why he took those actions and what was at stake. And so that reputation then gets perpetuated by the historical writing on him. And periodically, that would kind of bubble into the popular press, and you would get an example of that, like the Kentucky Explorer. I've seen local newspapers also who in the 80s and 90s would, you know, stumble across one of these monuments and go, huh, what's that? And then they would research it, and up would come these stories again. But always through this kind of pro-Southern or lost cause inflected view of Burbridge. So I think that's why it's persisted for so long. And I talked so long in that first part, I've forgotten the second part of your question.
So the second part is, what do you think is a fair assessment of him?
Well, he's definitely not a hero. I mean, I wouldn't paint him as a kind of radical Republican abolitionist hero who was believed firmly in racial egalitarianism and was willing to, you know, go to the mat for abolition. What he was an unconditional Unionist, an ambitious unconditional Unionist. So when the policy of the war was early on was to return slaves who came into the lines to their owners, he did that. And when the policy of the war changed to favor emancipation, then he did that. But he went all in on the policies that were coming down from his superiors because he believed fervently in the restoration of the Union. And he believed that the measures that were being undertaken were important for the restoration of the Union. And that is a kind of Union at any cost ideology, is something that's not ordinarily portrayed in kind of contemporary popular Civil War mythology. Most people are either pro-abolition or they are pro-Southern, but there aren't, you don't see like depictions of people who really just believed in the importance of restoring the Union and the crushing of the rebellion. And I think that's where Burbridge falls. But in terms of like the kind of anti-racist heroes of the Civil War, like the Sumners and the Frederick Douglasses. He's not in their league at all. He's definitely not a hero in that regard. He was a guy who implemented the policies that his superiors believed would bring the war to a quick end. And he was willing to do that, even though it endangered slavery and his own reputation. And he was willing to undertake those measures because he believed that crushing the rebellion was the most important thing.
Well, I've spoken in the past on this podcast about the narrative of the myth of the lost cause that Southern historians put together after the Civil War to argue that it was about states' rights, not slavery, the positive aspects of the South, and to paint different Confederate leaders as heroes and Robert E. Lee as a genius. And that narrative stayed around for a very long time. It was really only challenged by mainstream historians in more recent generations, but there's still large parts of it that affect popular consciousness and people like this that you've highlighted in your book. It's only by revisiting their legacy, many of whom haven't gotten their fair shake, that we can uncover stories like this. So for those who want to see how this is done and to learn more about what we can only discuss here in brief, the name of the book is The Most Hated Man in History, The Lost Cause and the Legacy of Union General Stephen Burbridge. Brad, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Scott. Really enjoyed it. Great conversation.
All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.